to Orphan Entertainment, the podcast dedicated to exploring the universe of public domain media. My name is Christopher. The task I've set out for this podcast is too much for one person alone, so joining me today to aid in the discussion is Lydia. Welcome back, Lydia.
Thank you.
This time around, we will be discussing 1948's He Walked by Night, directed by Alfred Werker and starring a young Richard Basehart, who will go on from this to nearly five decades of film and television work. His last performance was as Wilton Knight and the opening narrator in the 80s series Knight Rider, which kind of surprised me until I pulled it up on IMDb.
But, you know, he has that voice where you go, "Why? Where have I heard it before?" And then it starts dead end.
Knight Rider, a shadowy flight into the dangerous world of a man who does not exist.
This movie was based on the real-life events of Erwin Machine Gun Walker. So as the movie says, the events are real. Only the names have been changed to protect the innocent.
But it's not true. We'll cover that later.
Okay, I'm interested to know what you mean by that.
Oh, yes.
Well, the movie opens up with a little history lesson sort of thing. Or not really a history lesson. I don't know. What would you call it? About Los Angeles.
A tour guide. It's kind of a tourist narration almost. Los Angeles, the city of cities, where everybody comes to play. Only, obviously, that's not actually what it says, but it kind of sounds that way.
It does feel that way. I think one of my favorite things it says is it's a collection of suburbs looking for a city.
What does that even mean?
I think it was referring to how diverse all the different areas of L.A. was.
I have this image in my mind of all these little, you know, areas of the town carrying pitchforks and torches. Looking for the city, you know. Why?
Well, we also get a nice infomercial about the Los Angeles Police Department.
Well, I think they're trying to... I mean, bearing in mind this was probably the intro to, like, I'm not even sure what the genre would be now, but, you know, shock crime drama, I guess. I get the real impression this was probably one of the first ones to be, you know, true story about this violent crime, you know. So there were still... using Hollywood production values, but they were trying to make it as realistic as possible. So it's like they're trying to do it as, you know, those 1940s and 50s videos that they would show in schools, you know, educational videos almost. Like they're trying to make it seem more real because by having this narration going over.
Well, once we get into the actual film or the actual story, we see a officer heading home, as he always does, and he spots a suspicious-looking character hanging around an electronics store and goes in to check it out and ask him a couple questions. He asks this guy for some ID, and the poor fella gets a bunch of bullets in his chest instead.
You, mentioned that the line in this is great. I seem to have left my wallet at home, and then the officer says, "Well, I'm gonna have to see some kind of ID." And what is it he says?
What about my army discharge papers?
Right.
I got them right here.
And he pulls it out and, you know, bang, bang. And then you have this weird moment where he starts to run away. And then the police officer, like, drives his car into the other guy's car. I couldn't tell if it was on purpose or not, but it seemed logical, you know, to prevent him.
No, I think so. I think that was like a last desperate, you know, this guy shot me. I can't let him get away. And I think it was like a last desperate act.
Well, the funny part was I didn't really realize that was his car until I guess the guy grabs something out of it and then runs away. But at first it just looks like the officer is just driving into this random car.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, I think the crook actually heads for the car.
Oh, is that what happens?
We don't know it's his car. He's definitely heading for the car. We find out later that it was indeed his car.
Based on the arsenal of weapons in the trunk.
Yes, exactly. Well, this crook, I should mention, is Richard Basehart in one of his earlier roles. I think this is only his third or fourth film, so a very young actor. Playing a very cool and collected villain, a really good villain for a 1940s movie, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is. He's very smooth and kind of creepy.
Well, the cops are on the scene. They're checking out this car, which they've discovered appears to be the crook based on the evidence that they're finding in it. Yes, the arsenal of weapons in the back. They find a bottle of what appears to be nitroglycerin in the glove box.
A machine gun in the back and
Some sort of electronics, foreshadowing there. I do like it. This happens all the time in some of these older films. Well, I shouldn't even say older films. It happens even in modern films.
Well-made modern films. In B films. Yeah, lots of B films. Exactly.
But the officer happens to be asking one of the witnesses to, Katie, give me a description of the guy. He's like, well, I already told the officer he was. And then the radio just volume mysteriously turns up. And you hear the woman, the police dispatcher, giving the description. And then the radio.
Dark hair, regular features, medium height, right. Medium build. So in other words, he looks like just about 85% of the male population. Exactly. Oh, but with a pencil mustache.
Pencil mustache, right. And then the radio is mysteriously, as the volume increases, it decreases.
Stop.
And it fades away.
Is that about it? Sounds about right, officer.
Sounds right. Handy that radio did that right at that moment.
I would have had to repeat myself otherwise.
Exactly.
Who was first on the scene, reported it?
I was. I live here. I'm a light sleeper, but my hearing is good. And my cat.
Did the officer say anything before he collapsed?
Yeah, he gave a description of the fella.
Shooting of the officer. Suspect is a white male American, age 26 or 7, 5 feet 10 or 11, 155 to 165 pounds, brown hair, regular features, pencil mustache. Repeat broadcast. All units.
Is that about it?
Yes, sir, exactly. And the officer kept saying, he looked like such a nice kid. He looked like such a nice kid. As if he couldn't believe what had happened to him.
All right, well, Police Captain Breen assigns Sergeant Marty Brennan and Sergeant Chuck Jones, not to be confused with the voice actor and animator.
Can we call them Marty and Huck for the rest of the time? Because I feel a little what is it? Oh, I can't say it. That's it. No Jewish for Lydia. All right, sorry. Oh, yes. God. Sorry, listeners. I'm just offending everybody today. Sorry. So, Marty and Huck.
I don't even know why you're going there.
Seemed like a good idea at the time.
Well, anyway, these two sergeants are assigned to the case, and they start the stop and frisk and start pulling in all the usual suspects.
No, the dragnet.
Yes, the dragnet. Yes, and this one it is the dragnet.
The stop and frisk sounds a lot more entertaining.
Yeah. Thank you, narrator, for describing it as the dragnet.
The narrator makes the point that dragnet. Mm-hmm. They bring in the dragnet, which catches lots of fish, strange fish, and many ordinary ones, too. And then those fish get tossed back into the sea. There's a lot of fish going on here. It's like I think they're trying to use, a more eloquent language, unlike I'm able to do at the moment. But it falters and gets kind of fishy.
It gets fishy, yeah. Well, it gets like fish. It gets a little old after a few days.
It starts to stink. Yeah.
It starts to stink.
God, it does. And then I love it. He says, I just like, as I was rewatching it, jotting down a couple things, he says, there's many slightly shady characters that needed a lot of verifying, which begs the question, if they're slightly shady, why do they need a lot of verifying? If they're just slightly shady, slight verifying. But no, slightly shady characters are much more dangerous than really shady characters.
Apparently. Yeah, our cast of characters are, the rough guys, and they got the silly guys, they got the Chinaman no one can understand. All pretty typical stuff, I guess, for the time.
Yeah, and it's funny, this is one of those scenes I think we talked about that kind of drags out, where you keep expecting there to be some key piece of evidence that shows up during all of these interviews that they do with all these different guys that the dragnet has pulled in. It just turns out to be, nope, just this is what happens in the police department.
they do spend a lot of time. I mean, even there's this one rough group, and this is the leader, and he's wanted for armed robbery, blah blah.
What do they call him? Pretty boy or handsome?
Pretty boys, And they go all through this, and it means absolutely nothing
they
to the rest of
them.
It is just this is how the police department works.
And I love that they take a moment with the narration to tell you police work isn't just fun and play.
Right.
Well, yeah, right?
Yeah. Here I thought it was. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, about this time, we, and again, thanks to the narrator, we discover that the officer that was shot has died. So now we're looking for a police killer.
And I'm sorry, it's not funny. But the way that they do all this is early in the early hours of the morning, the news comes, and then the wife starts crying, but he doesn't say. I was again confused because initially I thought that he had been killed, and then when I rewatched it, I thought, well, no, maybe he hadn't, But then there's just this lady crying. It's funny because they make a point to tell you that the news came, but then they don't tell you what the news was.
Well, but you definitely get the idea. I actually kind of like that scene because they don't have to really say it out loud. You can get all the information you need from what is going on.
That's true, but they do tend to say it out loud even though they don't need to. There's a lot of narration in this.
You're right. It was odd for the narrator to not, to not go into, the officer has shoved off this mortal coil. He's left the building.
Like a fish
train
escaping
the station.
He slides off into the water. What? I guess it's only the bag or the suspects that are called a fish. The police aren't allowed.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, we see our crook at his home, and he's got a police radio, and he's listening to all the broadcasts that are going around. And, of course, since his pencil-thin mustache was the only outstanding feature outside of being a normal-looking guy, he shaves that off.
Like a sly, sly crook.
Oh, he is a sly.
I like his kind of chuckle of his evil chuckle of slyness.
Oh, yes. As the announcer, what kind of man is he that would do this?
Yeah. Exactly. That would shave a mustache.
Would kill a man and then nonchalantly go home and shave. What kind of man is this?
But we do see him also during the scene changing the license plates out on his car. So you can see, he's clearly, and he's got, I think, several stacks of license plates.
Several.
You can tell that he's been preparing for this kind of thing.
Yep, license plates, forged registrations. He is definitely a career criminal, and he is truly thinking this stuff through, which, of course, makes him that much more dangerous. Well, we get to the crime lab, which is ran by Lee Whitey, played by Jack Webb, who will go on to Dragnet, which this film has been accredited as being the inspiration for the radio show and TV program.
And honestly, I think that it probably should get credit for being the inspiration behind a lot of police drama. There's a standard storyline watching it the second time especially, I noticed this storyline that you see not only in police movies but also in pretty much every episode of police dramas on TV as well. We can talk about that a little bit more later, but I think it's influenced. I think this movie actually can be credited for influencing the whole police drama genre.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, we do get to see a little scene with the nitroglycerin, which made you think that this was going to be really important, but it's really kind of played off as just a little bit of a humorous moment between Whitey and the off. Oh, I hate his last name.
Whitey? Isn't that one of the kids in, oh no, all of you are yelling it at me. I can hear you. Wasn't Whitey one of the little rascals?
Possibly. I don't know.
All you guys that remember the little rascals, you're going, yeah, Whitey.
Well, if they're listening to a podcast about a film from 1948, they know
they probably do.
Yeah, but anyway, the whole nitro scene, he does the little drops in the blast case, and he uses a hammer, and he hits. I thought it was a funny scene. He hits the hammer, and then he pulls out, and it's just a handle left. The head of the hammer's gone.
Right.
Yeah. Yep, it's nitro.
And then the boss says, "I asked for fingerprints, not fingers." Right. Yeah. It's again, it's kind of one of those that, and then there was a moment a little bit later on where the, I think the police chief gets a brain flash and, is that the word I want? And he, calls another guy to ask if it, I'm not sure if it's further in the film or at this point, but they start asking because they notice that the radio equipment, you know, in the back of the car, well, thinking that it may be related to some other radio robberies.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And but what cracks me up about that scene, though, is he calls the other branch or the other department, whatever it is. I guess he's calling.
He's calling robbery.
Robbery. Thank you.
Different department.
He's
right.
calling robbery. And the first thing he says is, you know, hey, Mac, or whatever the guy's name is. Yeah. Oh, how was the daughter's wedding? And it shows it clips over to the other guys in the room and they all kind of go, ha, ha, ha. And I thought, so funny about the daughter's wedding? I guess maybe you just had to be there, but it was like, ha, ha, your daughter got married. And
Well, this was – I might as well bring this up now. I was going to bring it up later when we're done discussing it, but I'll bring it up now. What struck me about this movie is it really plays out like it's a mid-season television show.
It really does. It really
and
does.
It's like you're supposed to know all these characters and why – the way they interact with each other. A lot of them have their little quirks. They have this relationship together. They have this the humor, you know, the barbs back mm-hmm. and forth. You really feel like you were supposed to already know these people.
You're kind of the outside looking in on it. And it's interesting because they don't take the time to introduce you to anybody outside of this specific case. You don't see families. You don't build a rapport with any of the characters. The only character you kind of build a rapport with a little bit is the one played by, oh gosh, I'm sorry. The one
Richard Basehart.
Thank you, Richard Basehart. I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me. But he's the only one that you see in any capacity outside of just working the police beat. So it's kind of strange the way it's put together because you're watching it and you should be siding with the police because you know this guy's dangerous. He's a police killer. But really, the only person that you have a chance to bond with in this movie is actually the bad guy.
It actually makes it almost not work because, like you said, you feel like you're out on the outside looking in. And so when they have these little moments and these little jokes between them, you're just kind of like, I don't care. Could you get on with the case?
Yeah, or what was that about? Why are you laughing at the daughter's wedding? It's so mean. Is the guy ugly? Is the daughter ugly? What's going on here? So, you know, just another one of those, you know, kind of along the same lines as the narration. It's kind of a little, it's awkwardly put together.
Well, about this time, after we get done with our phone call and we realize that these electronics robberies might be connected to our crook, we see our crook heading for Reeves Electronics. And it looks like he's been building, or as it turns out, he's actually stealing. I'm kind of jumping ahead a little bit, but he's stealing electronics and passing them off on his own, perhaps modifying them slightly, to a electronics store who would then, I take it, kind of rent them out
give him a percentage. Them. Exactly.
Yeah, consignment. Thank you. And so that's how he's making his money. The owner of the electronics store is played by Whit Bissell, which is a ridiculous name, but a character actor that just has a list of films. I knew him as soon as I saw him. I recognize his voice. I recognize his face. That man has been in a ton of things. If you've seen anything through the 50s, 60s, 70s, you've seen Whit Bissell. And so I thought that was really cool to see him in this film. That's one of the things I love about going back and watching these older movies, is seeing some of these actors I have grown to recognize as they're older, and I get to see them much younger, and it's a lot of fun.
Silvergrass. Well, there are plenty of these around, Roy.
Not like this one.
Yes, I see. I suppose, as usual, you've added your own improvements. You know, it seems wrong that a man of your talent should bother consigning equipment for rental. I'd like to see you devote yourself entirely to experimental electronics.
It'll come one day. I love a place like this.
Well, why wait? I've got a pretty good setup here. You'd have modern equipment to work with, a lab. and my confidence.
Thanks, Mr. Reeves. I have other plans.
But, Roy, you can't tell where it'll lead. Might even work your way around to a percentage of the business.
I like it this way. You just run out my equipment.
And that's interesting. He's not even a character that it occurred to me to look at and, you know, kind of get into depth on. So now you have me really curious. Of course, the first thing that pops up is Falcon Crest. That's brilliant. Heart to Heart, Dukes of Hazzard. I mean, he was pretty much every TV show of the 80s, but I guess, and didn't do a whole lot after 1984. I'm assuming he passed away at that time.
He actually lived to be 1996, but yes, he did retire in the mid-80s.
Good for him for not passing away in 1984.
But no, yes, he appeared in almost every television series you can name through the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. He really is someone that if you watch TV like I did through the 70s and 80s, you saw Whit Bissell.
Now, let's talk about the 70s. Moving on.
Yeah, let's do that. You know, when I mention these actors, I keep forgetting that there's about a decade between us.
It's okay, I forget.
It doesn't always work.
I get in a complimentary way. I do forget, you know.
Yeah.
Or is it? So we get to this electronics store and find out, of course, he's selling these. There's somebody interested in his television projector, is what they call it. And, you know, and at first he says, oh, no, it's not ready yet. And as the owner of the proprietor of the consignment shop, you know, kind of presses him. He says, okay, well, it'll be ready tomorrow. And he says, oh, you said it wasn't done. He said, oh, it'll be ready by tomorrow. And sure enough, Tomorrow rolls around.
And then he comes with the television projector. And have you noticed that people are really fond of their electronics in this movie?
How so?
It's something I noticed Lee, Jack Webb's character, you know, the CSI guy, Lee Whitey, do to the electronic device they found in the crook's car. He sits there as he's talking to him. He's sitting there and he's like caressing it. And then in the electronics store is, you know, as Roy's talking about, oh, we have a name for our crook too. His name is Roy.
It is Roy. Thank you.
Yeah. As he's describing the item, he's sitting there.
I did
he's like
notice it.
Doing this, almost really uncomfortable caressing of the electronic
the box. Yeah. It's funny because I noticed it though in this scene. I didn't notice it in the other one. But yeah, he's kind of rubbing it.
Yeah. Yes, he is. It's a little odd.
Yeah, it is a little strange. I just assumed it was poor direction. Or maybe a nervous habit.
I don't know.
But he seems eager to disappear before the buyer shows up for, you know, to buy this projector. So sure enough, he says, you know, oh, just make sure you get a good price and scuttles off.
Right. And the guy that is interested in buying it that comes in and thinks it's an absolute beautiful piece of machinery because he built it. Turns out Mr. Reeves has been ripped off. This guy's been selling the stolen stuff.
Yes. No.
Well, the cops are, of course, called down to the scene, and so they figured it might be connected to everything, and so they decide to put up a little sting to try to catch this crook. So they have Mr. Reeves say that Roy calls, they have Mr. Reeves tell him that, oh, yeah, he sold it. He's got his check. He just has to come by tonight and pick it up, and the cops are going to sit there and wait and try to catch him. Unfortunately, things go south. And one of the cops gets shot, as does Roy.
That's right. Roy gets shot.
He guns a cop down, but the cop manages to fire off a few shots of his own, nailing Roy apparently once in the chest or in the gut. Because the next time we see Roy, he's doing a little self-surgery to remove the bullet.
Totally reminded me of, I may call this the wrong name, Labyrinth, the Italian one. Not what is that called? You know the one I mean, where he sews up his own face.
No.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay. Never mind. Those of you that have seen it, you're all going, it's called something else. But no, this is actually this scene to me was, aside from the fact that they show his facial expressions for certain things, where you know he's like pressing, you can see that he's pressing, you know, cloth to his injury. And then when he takes it away and he, you know, pulls out a pair of, I think, tweezers or something like that, or
Yeah, he pulls out a couple of tools that apparently he's got in some boiling water, so he has to pull them out and
shake them up. But and then it shows his face as he's doing this, and you got to think that for this time period, this is really pretty grotesque. I mean, the concept of this guy pulling his a bullet out of his own body, people in the audience at this time period would be, you know, probably really horrified by it. Some people would be, oh, I can't watch this. You know, here we're used to blood splatter and all that kind of thing, but this is, you know, 65 years ago, and people weren't used to this kind of really graphic kind of treatment of the human body, I suppose.
Oh, yeah. No, for 1948, this was gore.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Well, we find out that Sergeant Chuck Jones there, the one who was shot, is going to live, but it looks like he's not going to walk again.
Huck.
Yeah, thanks.
Sorry, I couldn't resist. But apparently, yeah, he's not going to walk again.
Captain Breen leaves Marty on the case. Well, we find out that Roy, knowing that his electronic scam isn't going to work anymore, changes his M.O. and turns to armed robbery to make his money.
And he's extremely cunning.
Very cunning, wearing apparently different disguises, looking differently with each robbery.
Horn-rimmed glasses, what else is it? Horn-rimmed glasses, an eye patch, a Band-Aid on his nose.
Right.
I love that one, though. That's my favorite. Next time I rob a store, I'm going to wear a Band-Aid on my nose so people can't identify me.
Yeah. But to elude the police, we find out that he's using the underground storm drains in Los Angeles as escape routes. Again, thanks to the narrator.
A perfect place to hide weapons, to escape, to start a brothel, I suppose.
I don't know. All kinds of things.
All kinds of awful things.
Lydia, there's tunnels down there that two cars can drive two abreast.
You said breast. But yeah, you know, we get a view of the Los Angeles drainage system, not sewer system, which confused me at first. I thought if it's underground and it's a big pipe, it's a sewer. It's not, apparently. In this case,
it's a storm drain.
It's a storm drain.
Yes.
So he's not running around. You're not, you know, thinking, ew, wash your shoes. Okay, that's what I would be thinking. But they do an interesting tactic. And it's interesting. What's interesting to me about this movie is that you're seeing things that to us were going, well, duh, of course, that's how you pursue this kind of thing. You know, you have a forensic lab that is going to check for fingerprints. You have, you know, a sketch artist that's going to try and get a description of the person put together. But at this time period, apparently this is all very new technology. So so they do bring everybody together that's been robbed by Roy. And
right.
They ask them all to help by putting these slides together that have different hair, different eyes, different noses, mouth, chins. And they're going to use these different little slides and mix them up and see if they can get a picture of what he really looks like.
Exactly right, because they discover that apparently he fired a couple shots at one of the robberies, and Lee in the CSI department discovered that all these shots were fired by the same gun, the ones that killed the first officer, the ones fired in the robbery, and the ones that that injured Sergeant Jones there.
Because as you know, every discharge on a gun leaves a mark.
Yeah, leaves a certain mark, a unique signature, if you will.
I love the... Which, thank goodness that's not the narrator. It actually is lines from one of the characters in the film.
Yeah, they collect all the victims, and they go through, and they start doing the slides. They start with the hair, and they figure out... It was wavier, it was darker, and they figure out his eyes and his nose, and eventually they do come up with the face of Roy.
Which they immediately take out and start, you know, spreading around trying to find it. But he was as unknown as if he had lived in the 16th century. Which,
very interesting line, wasn't it?
Why the 16th century? Why not 100 years before? Why not the 14th century? Why the 16th century?
I thought that was, well, it was flowery.
Yeah.
Yeah, very flowery. Yeah, they take it to prisons. They take it to crooks, the jails. That no one in the underworld can identify this man. Well, not long after this, Roy pays a visit to Mr. Reeves to try to get some money to blackmail him. Or, well, I guess not blackmail, threaten him to just get some money out of him. Ends up get him a good beating while he's there.
Yeah, this is another one of those scenes where it's kind of drawn out. And it's almost like they're trying... It's like they're showing methodology instead of pushing the story forward. They're like, well, this is how you could do this, and this is how you could do that, without explaining it. But he's, you know, hiding in the closet, and then he says, no, go over there, sit down in the chair, and he's telling Reeves to do all this stuff. Pick up three books. Now look through the books. Now choose a book. And it's, you know, and they're trying, I think, to display how cunning this guy is to keep from getting caught. But it drags down a little bit. You're kind of going, okay, we get the points. What happens next?
Yeah, it does a little. It does make it slow down a bit. I like the fact that even after, you know, Reeves has been almost killed by this guy, and he's like, oh, I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm out of here. And the cops go, oh, I'm sorry, you can't do that. You're our bait.
Right.
Wow.
And he says, I've done enough. And he says, and they say, no one's done enough. No one will ever do enough until we catch this guy.
We're just going to throw an innocent in harm's way as many times as we can until it works.
Well, you know, I suppose this is in the era when the police had a little bit more lax sensibility toward their responsibility toward associates of known criminals.
Well, Captain takes Marty off the case, thinking that, you know, he's been on it for months, apparently.
Another one of those abrupt scenes where, hey, seems like things are picking up. We've got a description of the guy. And then all of a sudden, you need to take a break.
Yeah, you don't know anything that you didn't know in the first week, so you're off the case.
Even though you now know it's the same guy committing all these things. We've got a bullet, you know, we've got a gun that we can, well, a bullet that we can compare to a gun. We know what he looks like.
We've got bait.
But oh no, you don't know anything you didn't know in the first week.
Well, Marty goes and visits Chuck, who's recuperating at home, and Chuck gives Marty a good kick in the pants, figuratively.
Because he can't move his legs. That's awful.
Sorry.
An insensitive meanie. Oh, my goodness.
Well, how's it been going, Junior?
Oh, pretty good, Chuck. Pretty good.
Is that why you're off the case?
How'd you know?
Breen was in to see me this morning.
Oh. Suppose he also told you they put a new team on the case.
He told me everything.
Yeah. Let's see what his new boys dig up.
Well, maybe they'll examine the facts of the case a little more carefully.
What facts? That our man's sharp, that he's intelligent and works alone, that he has no record, never leaves a fingerprint and knows every move we make? Sure, plenty of facts, only they add up to nothing.
Sure, forget it. You got yourself a 10-day vacation. Go on down to the beach, get a suntan. By the time you get back, the case will be broken. Isn't that what you want?
You know better than that.
All I know is what I hear. You sit there batting your gums about how the old man let you down. Maybe he's trying to wake you up.
Got a funny way of showing it.
There you go, flying off the handle. Always taking things for granted. I wish I could get up and boot some sense into you.
He knew what this case meant to me.
He still does. That's why he's trying to get you mad enough to do something about it.
And Chuck apparently comes up with the idea that the crook may be an inside man, maybe a cop or an ex-cop.
He seems to be one step ahead of him.
Exactly. Always knows what we're doing and how we're going to do it. So it could be an inside. That was something no one wanted to think about, but.
And then he says, what would you do? The first thing I'd do is I'd go to our department and ask around or look through the files. And then I'd go to every other one.
Right. So, which is what he does.
So Marty, being on his vacation as he is, you know, just like the classic good guy cop that, you know, gets, you know, beat up or something like that. And.
Right.
Again, his boss takes him off the case, and he's like, oh, down on his luck. And then he gets this brilliant idea and decides that he's going to go work on his while he's on his vacation.
Well, Marty takes the photo of the guy around to all the different precincts. No one seems to recognize him, though, and all appropriately a little bit hostile at the very idea that he thinks that a cop might be responsible for all this.
And so the tedious quest went on. Sergeant Brennan wore out his shoes and his patience, going from police station to police station, checking photos until his eyes were blurry. For police work is not all glamour and excitement and glory. There are days and days of routine, of tedious probing, of tireless searching. Fruitless days. Days when nothing goes right, when it seems as if no one could ever think his way through the maze of baffling trails a criminal leaves. But the answer to that is persistence and the hope that sooner or later something will turn up. Some tiny lead that can grow into a warm trail and point to the cracking of a tough case.
But then One gentleman realizes that recognizes him as being a radio technician that worked at the their precinct right before the war.
That's right.
And so now they have a name to go with the face, a real name. His name is Roy Morgan. But yeah, still no address on him. Don't know where he's from.
Oh, but they do see that he did reply with a letter saying, no, he doesn't want to work for the police anymore. And the post stamp was from Hollywood.
Hollywood, yeah. Hollywood. And this is just, I don't know, either odd or just really good police work. Marty goes to the mailman and starts sharing the name to see if any of them recognize him from their route.
And the photo, hey, have any of you guys seen this guy? Does he look familiar to you? No. He doesn't look familiar. Nobody's seen him.
Except one guy. It might be nothing, but...
Yeah. But I happen to know exactly where this guy is. It might be nothing, right. But I've seen this guy before. What?
he never gets mail or nothing, but, you know, I've seen him. Yeah.
Because we're looking for his mail. We don't really care about the guy. If he's not getting mail, it's fine. Oh, yeah, never mind then. We're not interested. You're right. That's nothing.
Well, Marty poses as a milkman to go and check the guy out. Again, just... You know, interesting police tactics there.
And he gets stopped by a woman who says, there's something weird going on in here. And he says, oh, yeah, what is it? And she says,
scared to go to the police with it. I thought maybe I might be poisoned.
What?
Yeah. By the manager. She's a witch.
She's a what?
A witch. She puts poison in my milk.
Oh, I see. Switch the bottles when she isn't looking, see? Drink her milk. Then you'll be safe, right?
I do love his advice, though. Hey.
Oh, yeah.
Switch the milk when she's not looking. That way you won't get poisoned and she will.
Right.
Well, I suppose that's good police work.
Again, it's one of those odd moments that you don't expect in a movie, but you would have expected in a television
show. Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right.
Well, he does find out that Roy Martin is indeed in this... collection of what do they call it, little bungalows,
that's what I call it.
And so they know they've got their man, they know where he's at, so the cops move in. Unfortunately, Roy's dog tips him off that there's someone outside, and so he makes a break for it,
at which point all dialogue in the movie stops.
Yes, it's just running.
It is just running for the next 15 minutes.
Yep. I'll be sure to add that into the audio drops that I use.
Running for the next 15 minutes.
Well, Roy, of course, dives into the sewers to escape, but the cops spot him doing just that. So now they know where he's at and what he's been doing. So, again, the cops start a sort of dragnet as they cordon off and surround the different sewers and
drain thingies.
I keep saying, yeah, sorry. Storm drain, sewers.
Thank you, yes. But sure enough, just as it described earlier in the movie, this is the perfect place to hide guns.
Yeah, and he's got a nasty shotgun, which he ends up using several times firing down the tunnels. I have to think that this was, I mean, L.A. is really good at letting people in the 40s and 50s film in their storm drains.
Because
they did some pretty nifty, and I tell you what, I don't know if those were really blank. I mean, there was definitely real bullets flying at some points. That was a pretty powerful shotgun. He would fire, you'd see water ripple.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's not a detail that I would pay attention to, probably, because I'm a girl.
I only noticed it on like the second or third kind of watch. I was looking at it, and he fires, and there was some garbage or something laying down just below where he fired, and you see the thing kind of move. I'm like, holy crap.
Wow, now I want to watch it again.
But then you see several ricochets, you know, bounce off the walls right near him.
Chips,
so I'm like, wow.
Coming off, and yeah.
Yeah, safety levels in 1948 filming. Richard Basehart was really lucky he made it out of this film alive.
That's probably true. Assuming, of course, that he did.
Well,
it could have been a conspiracy cover-up by the government. Just kidding.
Yeah, next five decades of film, all faked.
All faked.
The world needs its Richard Basehart.
Yeah, otherwise, there'd be no Knight Rider.
That's right. Well, after an exchange of fire and a gas grenade, Roy is killed, and quite literally,
but
the end.
We're actually missing a part there, and I think my favorite part, the whole, and really there is some drama built in this scene, even though you have 15 minutes of him running from the police. It gets to the point where, you know, he's cornered. You can tell they're coming at him from at least two different angles and two of the different tunnels, and he climbs up into this kind of pigeonhole, and he's trying to get out, and he's pushing on the man cover, and you see that the police just happen to have parked a car right on top of the man cover.
Oh, I don't think it just happens. I think that was all planned. I think they probably had police cars parked on every manhole cover, you know, in the area.
They were like, quick, get the cars, sit on the manholes.
Well, they had plenty of them, because you saw those scenes where the, you know, motorcycles and police cars and radio cars were all storming out of the L.A. police department,
right,
over and over and over.
They have the cars
to do it.
So they had to get, you know, extra police in from other areas just to drive all the cars they had. But he is trying to get out, and you're kind of – and I was torn at this moment. I wasn't sure if I wanted him to escape or not, but – you are right. He does get shot and falls to the ground. Do they even say anything?
No, nothing. They
look
walk
down
up,
at him.
They roll him over. He's lying there with his eyes
staring,
open, dead. Yeah.
And then,
yep, the end.
Yep, the end of the movie.
That is something I really appreciate about the films from this era. When the story's done, that's it. There is no, well, that was quite the case. Hey, Bob, how about a beat?
Right.
Nothing.
Start at the beginning. When you get to the end, stop. That's exactly what they do.
All the wordy moments, we'll take care of that during the film, during the movie. Once the story's done, we're done.
In case you're worried what happened at the end. Nope, that's the end.
It would have been an interesting TV show, but I'm not sure if it was that great of a movie.
Again, I think the only real chance you have to bond with anybody is with Roy. And since he ends up dead at the end of it,
right,
you're not going, oh, wow, that was a great movie, I want to see it again. You're going, oh, well, they got him, you know? But yeah, it's not one of those movies that you just feel like, oh, this movie was a great movie, let's watch it again.
Yeah, I'm a little torn, though, because I have to admit, I liked the characters. I liked some of these characters, and I liked some of the little quirks.
Yeah, I wanted to see more of them. I wanted
to see more.
Exactly. I wanted to know more about Marty. And when he survives, they have this kind of sense of humor that you don't even see until three quarters of the way through the movie, and they're kind of ribbing each other, you know, and you're like, oh, these are really cool guys. And
then
the movie is over.
Yeah, and it's talking about Chuck. I mean, he's shot and paralyzed. We see him shot, and the next time we see him, he's in his wheelchair, but he's like completely, you know, accustomed to it now.
Yeah.
He's all jovial. He's happy. Oh, blah, blah. Yeah,
he's got a nurse.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where you don't see any of the interim. You don't see him like, what do you mean, Doc? What do you mean? I know I'm going to walk. No, nothing. Just,
exactly.
Oh, I'm in a wheelchair. This is my nurse. She's awesome. She gives me a bath, wink, wink. Talking about quirks, I love that you notice that wherever Marty goes, you know, he smokes, but he never carries a match.
Oh.
Every time he pulls out a cigarette, he's patting his pockets for a match, and someone else has got to give him a light.
That's
every
hilarious
time.
I didn't actually notice that, but, you know.
And even the other characters, I mean, Chuck will throw him a book of matches, and he'll light a cigarette, and he goes to hand it back. He's like, nah, you keep that. But, of course, the next time he goes to light a cigarette, he doesn't have it anymore.
So, yeah, the characters in it are good characters, but you have this kind of strange storytelling that where you don't – it's like it's an instructional video. It's not – they don't try and draw you into the lives of any of these characters.
Amazingly well-defined characters in a not-so-well-defined movie, maybe?
Possibly. I feel like they kind of missed it on the genre. I feel like if they had not tried to make it this is a true story, if they had just gone with a Incredible Tales kind of feeling to it, it would have been more successful. It would have been, you know, I don't know if successful is the right word, but more enjoyable.
Well, it's certainly interesting to watch knowing that it was, and as you said, the inspiration. Well, it was the inspiration for Dragnet, and definitely can be credited for the inspiration for dozens of, you know, pretty much if you've seen any cop-based, you know, crime drama, I mean, you've got this movie to thank for.
Yeah, I had to map it because as I was watching it again, I thought this is because the first time I watched it, I thought, story. It's fine. It's OK. The second time I was watching it, I thought, you know, and I noticed that you kind of get an intro to forensics in it and you kind of get that. Oh, there's a bit where they start profiling. And I think we kind of glossed over that. But the CSI guy, you know, he says, oh, they say, well, we don't know anything about him. And he says, well, that's not true. We know that he's intelligent. We know that he's got some kind of an electronics background. And he starts talking about, you know, his what kind of a person he is, not necessarily what his fingerprints look like or what his face looks like, but this is the kind, you know, it's the first profiling that we see. And maybe ever in any movie, it'd be interesting to know if this is the first time that they ever kind of start publicizing that, because it's such a prevalent part of police dramas today. But as I was watching it the second time, aside from noticing that, I realized, you know, it starts off with the crime. And then it goes on to say, you know, this is the crime, but there are no clues. There's nothing we can do to follow it. Oh, but look, we've got this new technology. Let's start following that. You know, whether that be the profiling or getting a bunch of people together in a room to do a sketch, which they've never done before because they got this technology, I think they say, from Chicago. And then they go on to criminal almost gets caught. And so he changes his ways. And then, you know, the cop gets discouraged or something happens and he gets kicked off the case. And then he comes up with some brilliant idea. And at the end, they catch the criminal using technology and sheer pluck. Yeah. And it's the standard storyline that we use now in basically every single police drama.
Absolutely.
You see almost no variation on that anymore. So it's interesting to see it in this and wonder, since this was the inspiration for Dragnet and, you know, obviously influenced so many other shows, you wonder if this isn't the beginning of it, if this wasn't the first time that was ever that particular progression showed up on film.
We haven't discovered anything thus far that would give us any indication otherwise. So, but, you know, maybe through our future watches, maybe we'll find something else that predates it. But for now, I say, no, this is where it all began.
Seems to be. So interestingly, we mentioned that this is based on a true story. Only the names have been changed to protect the innocent. But I did look up Erwin Walker, who this movie is based on his events. This in the movie, the Roy uses a pistol a lot. They have a machine gun in the back of his car, but he was called Erwin Machine Gun Walker because he actually used a machine gun in his shootings. But we don't see that in this movie. So there's a major plot difference. And then also, even bigger than that, I think, is Erwin Walker was taken alive. He did not.
Oh, was he?
Yes. He did not actually end up being shot by the police. He went to jail. He went to jail. He did some appeals. Eventually, he was released from jail. He got a pardon by, I think, the governor of California and ended up living out his life, changing his name and living out the rest of his life in anonymity until he died, I think, in the mid-80s. So, interesting to know this movie, you know, it's exactly true story, not actually exactly the true story.
Well, I guess they probably maybe be loosely based on the real life events.
Exactly.
I think it maybe was based more on the man, the character, rather than the actual events that transpired around him. He was a former police officer and Army electronic. I think he was actually in the Signal Corps or something.
I think he served two tours overseas. I read the thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not brilliant. He did serve in the South Pacific. He did work for, I believe he was a dispatcher for the police, but you may be right. He may have actually been an officer before he got.
I'm speaking out of turn. It just says he was a Glendale, California Police Department employee and World War II veteran. I was speaking a little bit out of turn.
And radio operator of Glendale Police Department. So the other difference is in the movie there, you know, describing him as a cold man. He does never seem to smile and he's got small beady eyes. But prior to his turn of service and I think maybe even afterwards, everybody that knew him and spoke with him, he was really warm, really caring. I know that the guy who recognizes him in the movie says, oh, yeah, he always kept to himself and never talked to anybody else. But, you know, all the reports from that time period in Walker's life were that he was, you know, very outgoing and warm and caring and an enjoyable guy to be around. And all of that changed when his basically his unit in the South Pacific was destroyed. And then after that, he kind of lost it.
So the events that we're discussing then were the results of the, one of the early cases of post-traumatic stress
syndrome. Exactly. And the way they describe, no, it really is true.
It's exactly what you're saying. Yeah.
And he just kind of lost it and thought the government was conspiring against him and decided to, I think he claimed that he was trying to get money so that he could give it to other veterans.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, you know, that's one thing we've never really got the motivation for in the movie was why he needed the money at all.
Exactly. Yeah, you never find.
We knew he was an electronics expert. He was, you know, stealing electronics and selling them for money. And then he was doing the armed robbery. But we never really found out why he was doing any of it. What his motivation for, other than just that was just how he wanted to live, which. It seemed odd because
he's living in this little Reeves, tiny bungalow.
Right. And Reeves even offers him a job that could potentially give him a share in the company, you know, eventually. And he turns it down. He just wants to keep doing what he's doing. So you assume there was some other motivating factor, but.
Well, and the real guy, you know, claimed insanity. Apparently there was insanity on both sides of his families, but he was, the judge essentially said, the whole time we've been in trial, you're just showing how intelligent you are. I think the quote is, I seldom recall a more intelligent witness, you know, that gave better responses and all of that. So so it's interesting. I mean, he clearly was a very intelligent guy. He clearly had a plan for what he was doing. But as far as, you know, what really was going on in his mind, whether or not it was accurately portrayed in the movie.
But no, it was still fun to watch. And, you know, I was just glancing over the wiki page of all places again. And it does make note of the camera work that was done in this film. And I do have to agree that is one highlight of this film. I think there is some really good camera work, although a lot of it is some kind of neat shots when they're in the storm drains. Mm-hmm. When they're above ground, I think it all seems pretty normal, but there are some really neat long shots down the storm drains and even some close-ups just as you know, with only the bare little bit of light shining against the faces.
Yeah, I definitely
make it
feel
really interesting.
Yeah, I definitely feel like the kind of the end of the movie is the highlight that you get a whole lot of most of the drama and the tension builds during the end.
Yep. Yeah. Actually, the 15 minutes without the dialogue
is probably the best part.
But pretty interesting. You know, it's an easy watch, if not necessarily the best film that we've ever watched. It is an easy one to watch. So on that, I would say I would probably recommend it. And I would be curious to know if anyone who hasn't seen it, if they feel the same as us, is that you just want to see more of these characters and you just find yourself really disappointed that the movie's over and you'll never see him again.
Yeah, I wanted to see Marty go home to his wife and, you know, we kind of, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm a girl, but we want to see that happy ending.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that is going to do it for us today. I'd like to thank all our regular listeners of the podcast, and I certainly send a welcome to any new listeners. I hope you continue to download future installments of Orphan Entertainment, which, of course, you can easily do by subscribing via iTunes. And while you're there, rate us, leave a comment. We'd love that. If you'd like to get in touch with us with any suggestions, comments, or general feedback, you can join us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/groups/orphanedentertainment. And you can leave a short voicemail using the SpeakPipe app on our homepage. And you can drop us an email at orphanedent@janja.net. And all those links are going to be in the show notes. So, Lydia, thank you very much for joining me on this one.
Thank you, Christopher.
Thanks, everyone, again for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Bye.
Bye.